This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
And of course, it was yet another big, big mailbag. And so now it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh, yes. James Messick, he's one of our regular listeners, sent an email. He says, Dear Dr. Schertz, Microsoft used to offer a free service to keep designated files and folders in sync on various computers. It synced from computer to computer without storing the data in the cloud. And it was a service and a device that I liked using, but now Microsoft has unfortunately shut this service down. I'd like a solution for syncing directly over the local internet. Do you know of any such solution? I now have Microsoft SkyDrive, which gives me 25 gigabytes of free online storage, but somehow it's a different animal. I'd like something like I had before. Do you have any suggestions? Well, I do have a suggestion, James. There is Microsoft SyncToy. .2.1, SyncToy, S-Y-N-C-T-O-Y, 2.1. It's a free application that synchronizes files and folders between different computers on the same network. Typical users include sharing of files, such as photos, or creating backup copies of files and folders. It was released in 2009 and is still available. It uses Microsoft Sync Framework 2.0. Now, it is not supported by Windows Tech Support because it's officially not one of the Windows services. But Microsoft has a whole group of power toys that you can download and play with, and they offer them, you know, but they don't support them, and so that's probably why you didn't see it. So simply Google SyncToy, S-Y-N-C-T-O-Y, download it, and I think you'll have exactly what you need, James. Great question. We have an email from Ken. Dear Dr. Schertz, today's repeat show included topics of numerical weather forecasting, and you included mention of a website that sounded like No Gas. I wanted to see that website, and I searched the Tech Talk shows at Stratford EDU, and I eventually found the discussion on the February 13th, 2010 show. This was one of the best ofs.
This was last week. I know, because I'm the guy that put it together.
Okay. But I did not find a weather site by that name, and I searched for it. Well, Ken, this is actually interesting. I'm gonna have to make certain my searches are better. Well, it's not No Gas. I went back and looked. I was giving you like a sidebar, which wasn't in the notes. It turns out I was talking about the Navy Operational Global Atmospheric Prediction System, No Gaps, N-O-G-A-P-S. N-O-G-A-P-S.
Which I'm going to right now.
And now you can Google No Gaps, N-O-G-A-P-S, and you'll come up with an NRL site, and they give all of the world weather predictions there. And I like to use the NRL display of the No Gaps data, and that would be NRLMRY.Navy.mil/METOC. METOC/NoGaps, but
that's easy to remember.
Yeah, but I'm gonna post this link in the show notes today.
Okay, good.
Ken, so you can actually today No Gaps will be there, and there will be a link to it. And that was a great.
And I'm looking at it right now.
It was a great question, and it's and a reminder that I should make my notes very complete, even including the sidebar discussions.
Well, but you don't know when you're going to have a sidebar before you have a sidebar. That's the problem.
I have no idea because these sidebars just crop up in the show. So isn't that nice, the No Gaps data? It's got world weather patterns.
I'm actually looking at it right now. It's a very cool website.
We have an email from a Bethesda listener. This is a regular listener. Dear Dr. Schertz, I'm taking a CBT course. That's an online course, computer-based training course, she's saying, but it's actually an online course. It took a great deal of steps to get this working properly, and it all boiled down to a Java issue. I don't really understand Java, and I wish you would devote a segment of the program going over what the application does and what it and what it actually does. It appears to be powerful, and maybe it's worth learning. P.S. Is Sun Microsystems OpenOffice ever going to usurp MS Office? Well, let's talk about Java. As a programming language, I'll give you kind of a quick rundown of what it is, its advantages, why it was developed, and I'll give you a website where you can get more information. Java was developed by Sun Microsystems. Now, the Java programming language was designed to solve a number of problems that were encountered when using the programming language known as C++. C++ is an advanced version of C programming language, which allows you to create objects. It's object-oriented programming language. And C++, while it is a powerful language, is difficult to learn and difficult to use. And Java was designed to handle these deficiencies. Number one, Java is simplified. It basically, any of the function calls in C++ that really aren't used very much and are very complicated and have limited value, they just got rid of.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it has automatic garbage collection.
Ooh.
See, one of the problems with C++ is you allocate memory, then you've got to release memory, and there's a lot of memory management architecture that goes in with C++. Well, Java just handles all that memory management stuff, and then periodically it goes around and looks for memory that should have been released that wasn't released, and it gets rid of it. That's the garbage collection piece. So it automates stuff so the programmer can concentrate on solving the problem instead of just working on all of this detail stuff. It has a very small footprint for embedded applications. It was designed like you might have a Java application running in your microwave oven or in your refrigerator. Small processors that needed some computing power. So it was designed to be something much smaller. Whereas C++ requires a much bigger processor. Like, for instance, C++ is the programming language that was used to write Microsoft Windows, for instance. It also is internet savvy. It has a built-in library for all the networking functions, TCP/IP, so you don't have to actually program all these networking activities. It's just built into the library right out of the bat. It has very early error checking. What it does in the compiling process, it locates and identifies errors quickly so they don't remain undetected for a while, and it makes it easier for programming and for checking what you're doing. It also is secure. It has embedded encryption built right into it, so it has security built into it because it was designed to be used in an enterprise environment, internet connections, where you might have hacking options going on, and so they just built that right into the thing. It's architecture neutral. Now, that means it doesn't have to run on like an Intel chip or a Motorola chip. It basically can run on multiple kinds of hardware. And why is that? Because when you're hooked to the internet, you don't know what kind of computer is going to be on the internet. And you're going to want to be able to run Java on all those different clients all over the internet. So it's portable. You can take it from one machine to another. It's multi-threaded, so you can take advantage of the multi-threading features of the CPUs, which means you can actually do parallel processing. You do multiple things at the same time in order to speed the computation rate. And it's an interpreted language. That means you basically write the Java code, you run through one level of interpretation where the code is parsed, and then the final conversion to bits and bytes is done by the Java compiler at the machine that it's being used at. So that's how you can handle it on multiple machines and that sort of thing. So it's actually a very powerful language which was designed to write programs for the internet in a distributed environment. it actually was released by Sun by Sun Microsystems to the world, and if people that use it and embed it in their systems have to pay licensing fees to Sun, but actually everybody else can download the Java engine for their machine free of charge. If you want any more information on Java, go to java.sun.com, java.sun.com. And if you're an IT guy that wants to get into the programming world, Java is a pretty good language to start out with. Now, as for OpenOffice, I don't think it's going to surpass Microsoft Office for quite some time, simply because it doesn't have enough support. I mean, Sun manages OpenOffice. They've got it out there, and they did it to sort of, you know, poke Microsoft in the eye, I think. But they're not actually providing enough support. So the features of Microsoft Office are much more robust. They're coming out with more things. And so I use both. The advantage of Microsoft Office, of OpenOffice, is that you can download what is sort of like a Microsoft Office suite, and it's free. So you don't have to spend that $300 or $400. So if you're a student on a budget, and you need spreadsheets and word processors to do your work, you don't have money to spend $200-$300 on Microsoft Office, you can download OpenOffice for free, and that's because it's open source software, and you can just simply go to openoffice.org and download it. And a lot of our students at Stratford who can't afford Microsoft Office, in fact, use OpenOffice. It was a great question from our Bethesda listener. We have an email from Greg Johnson. Dear Dr. Schertz, when you first read a question on Tech Talk, it sounds like something my grandmother's less computer literate friends would ask.
Oh!
I guess I think they're kind of like, well,
ow.
I don't know what that means. But by the time you're done answering the question, I'm like, whoa, I didn't know anything about that topic. So it started out like a boom,
yeah,
and it ended up as a compliment. Thanks, Greg.
Talk about going through the back door.
That's right. Now, but then he gave me another zinger, the ads. Can you find some way to get a variety of real money-grubbing ads for yourself? Repeating the same long, poorly produced ads that Stratford has is driving me crazy. You know, I'll tell you, Greg, I don't control these ads, but, you know, I put this on the show because I'm just going to send this to our marketing department. I think we'll update the ads for the show. That's a great suggestion. Obviously, Greg Johnson is one of our podcast listeners.
Yes.
So he's listening to – and I guess if you're going to listen have a Tech Talk weekend and listen to 40 different Tech Talks in one weekend.
Theoretically, you could listen to 48 one weekend.
You could listen to 48 one weekend, and how many ads do we have? Like 4 or 5 ads. So that would be like listening to that same, you know, it'd be 200 ads in one weekend.
Correct.
I can see where it would be problematic.
Yes.
Okay.
So what are we going to change the ads or edit them out of the...
No, I'm going to leave the ads in because it's too much work to edit them out.
Oh, so we're just going to run some different ads.
I'm going to run different ads.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm going to
use this as a way to poke my marketing department.
You're quite the marketeer over
yes.
here.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We have an email from Marshall. Dr. Schertz advised last week, he's actually talking to me, but it's like he's talking about me.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Schertz advised last week that UMA will begin charging tax on March 23rd, 2012. Now, I've been considering getting voice over IP service for my home, but with a cursory glance at the UMA hardware, I'm wondering if I could use one device to VOPify my home. VoIPify my home. I've never heard of that word before. That's good. Voice over IP, VOIP. VoIPify my home. Can I plug the unit directly into my router, and then I've got my cordless phone. I got multiple handsets. However, how do I get voice over IP on all of the other jacks in my home for actual corded, the old style phones that plug in the wall?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you mentioned on the April 17th, 2010 show that faxing was bandwidth needy and needed a good internet connection. In your opinion, how would UMA or other voice over IP solutions work with my medium speed DSL internet connection? Do I have to bite the bullet and upgrade to a higher speed or cost option? Thanks for your research and putting on a great show every Saturday, a loyal listener for almost 10 years, Marshall. Well, Marshall, let's go back. Voice over IP, of course, is a way to avoid using the sort of the retail phone service of, say, like Verizon, and it allows you to call people at a very low price, maybe even free. And so people are going more and more to it. Ooma has a device that will take your phone. This is a sidebar. I know you already know this, Marshall. Ooma has a device. It's a small box. You plug your home phone system into it, and it takes the signals from your home phone system, converts them to computer packets, and sends them out over the internet. So it's voice over IP, where IP is internet protocol. And then it shoots it out, and all you need to have is a broadband connection to the internet for this thing to work. And the Ooma box that I have Ooma, it cost me around $200 to get the box, mm-hmm. and then I was paying $10 a year for my phone line.
Right.
I transferred my phone line to the Ooma service, and I paid $10 a year for that. And then they started taxing it at $3.75. So now I got to pay another $35 a year for taxes. So now I'm paying $45 a year for my phone line. And so that's okay. Rather than paying some $80 a month or something to Verizon for a phone line. So now the question is, how can you hook up your voice over IP system to the rest of the phones in your house? Now what I have actually... I've got a Uniden DECT 6 system, which is like I've got a base station and all these wireless phones.
Right.
So I simply take and plug the base station into my Ooma device, and bingo, every phone that's connected to the base station goes right out through the voice over IP system. It's very easy. But then I have a fax machine, which I have to plug into it. So I basically have a splitter, and I plug my fax machine into one connection to the splitter and my base station into the other. So then my fax machine works right through the voice over IP system. Now, what you can do, and so I didn't use any of the wires in my house, but I could have. I could have taken the one connection, which is, say, in the office, and plugged that into the back of the Ooma device. And then that means all the other connections in the house would be connected to the Ooma device through the home internal wiring network. But I have to disconnect that wiring network from the Verizon outside service. You can't have two phone ports into the same network. So you simply take and pull off the connection that connects you to the outside world, and then you continue to use your internal network and just plug that into the Ooma. Then if you've got the phone that's in the office that you want to plug into the Ooma and you're already using the wall connector, use another splitter, mm-hmm. and you can do that. So you can actually get it all. Now, as far as faxing being bandwidth needy, it does, because it sends a digital signal. You can slow your fax machine down. You can set the data rate on your fax machine. And since you're faxing, it's really the upload speed that counts. So you've got a DSL, digital subscriber loop, digital subscriber line, DSL, and many of them are ADSL, asymmetric DSL, which means you can have a fast download and a slow upload speed. You need a good upload speed on this. So I don't know what you actually have, so I can't answer the question. What you need to do is go to broadbandreports.com and do a speed test. Go to broadbandreports.com. There's the tool section. Select a speed test. It'll give you a download speed and an upload speed, and you can see what you've got. I'm going to think that you've got enough bandwidth, by and large. Most of the DSL systems are pretty good. I think you probably have enough bandwidth. Now, if you decide to do faxing with Ooma, you've got to disable the error correction, which is built into the phone service. Otherwise, the fax just doesn't work. So you have to, each time you make a fax call, you have to precede it with *99, mm-hmm. and that disables. That's just a small thing, but you'll get that in your instructions with Ooma. So just go ahead and try broadbandreports.com and see what you actually have. Most of the problems that people have who have voice over IP on their home network, if they have a teenager in the house that's downloading MP3s, say using BitTorrent, their teenager sucks up all the bandwidth, and then there's nothing left over for your phone calls.
Right.
So that's, if you don't have any teenagers, that's not a problem. If you do have teenagers, you've got to go into your home router and set up priorities and make their machine the lowest priority and make the Ooma device the highest priority. Mm-hmm. So that's probably more than you ever wanted to know about voice over IP.
Well,
but
it's instructive.
It's instructive. Now we have an email from, let's see here. Oh, yeah. Dear, from Anonymous.
Uh-oh.
From Anonymous. Please don't use my name on the air. So he's anonymous. He or she is anonymous. Dear Dr. Schertz, I've been unemployed for a very long time, and employers are not hiring me. Are employers using the normal hiring process or just hiring people as contractors, or are there different procedures out there for finding contracted jobs? Secondly, I've been told my PhD is worthless because it's from 1987. Is there any employer that will consider my degree valuable? Now that I'm told that my education and experience are worthless, I'm kind of discouraged. Thanks, Anonymous. So I left off his name. I'm going to send him back a personal email because he gave me more information that I'll share with him privately. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the thing. A degree is simply a check mark. It gets you in the door. It's what you've done after you got your degree that counts. It's the degree itself is not the ticket.
Right.
It's what you did after the degree itself. Now, what I would recommend, and most people underestimate what they've actually done, because things that come easily to them, they don't value that much, and so they can't articulate their skill set well. So I recommend that you read a book, What Color Is Your Parachute, by Dick Bowles. It helps you be very introspective to understand who you are, and it also gives you a method for locating a job. It's called the survey method. Instead of sending out a gazillion resumes, which is not that effective, you survey employers, find out what they need. You gather data, and through the process of gathering data, you yourself become more marketable. And in the process of honing your skills, you develop honing your ability to explain what you do well. You're essentially developing the elevator pitch. You know, you heard the elevator pitch when you're trying to get money for a new company.
Right.
You need an elevator pitch for yourself. Somebody, if you run the elevator, how could you explain in 30 seconds what you're good at, where you want to go, how you could contribute? You got to be able to consolidate that. And the techniques in What Color Your Parachute are absolutely, absolutely outstanding. We recommend that for all of our students. What Color Is Your Parachute by Dick Bowles. The other thing you might do, in your field, there are conferences, there are discussion groups, there are all kinds of organizations that you can join. So even though you're not employed, I would suggest you go to these organizations, you join them, you go there, you participate, you start doing things. And in the process of doing things, you're going to be perceived as more attractive. And so I think you can overcome this, but I think it's going to require a slight shift in attitude. And that's the same situation that we have with our students when they're looking for things. And the beauty of this surveying process is that you find out ultimately what the needs of an employer are, and then you propose a job that they need. It's sort of in the reverse thing. So you're in the top 5%. And that's explained in great detail in What Color Is Your Parachute? Great question. And I'm also going to follow this up, by the way, later on to talk about how the whole job market has shifted with the Internet. And we're seeing a whole upheaval on what's going on. We got an email from Margaret. Richard Schertz, I listen every Saturday.
So formal.
I know. I listen every Saturday and like your program. Yeah. I mean, the last one just was saying Richard Schertz was talking. That was a little impersonal.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a large tech company based in Japan, and I got a software course approved by my boss several months back, and I got it. But with great difficulties, I'm trying to get logged on, and I can't figure out what's going on. They told me I need Java 6.0 developer kit, I need a VPN, I need a PC, and I need a LAN. Well, it could be the Java, of course, is the local. You need Java 6.0, the developer kit, plus Java 6.0. You basically, you probably have some Java programs built into that course, and they've got to run on your machine, so you need the latest version of the Java engine to run it. So you got to have the latest version of Java. That's why they have that. They want you to have a VPN, virtual private network, so you can have an encrypted pipe between your computer and the course so that people can't intercept what's going on. Most people have a problem with the VPN configuration. Make certain that you're using the same VPN protocol that they have, and you can select that protocol. They'll tell you that they might give you a VPN client. Make certain you've got the right password. Now, the land settings, which they mentioned, and you want to know what that meant. You know, this is, are you going to do automatic detection of proxy and all that stuff? The land settings basically are, they set up your local area network at your house so you can reach the internet. Because clearly, if you can't reach the internet, you can't log on to a course which is in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And the land settings typically go out to the internet through a gateway, which is called many times a proxy server, because you make the request to it, and as your proxy, it makes a request to the internet for whatever site you want to reach. And you want to set your internet up for automatic detection of the proxy, and then it can automatically find where the gateway is and it goes out. You don't have any problem with your LAN settings if you can actually surf the web. So that's really pretty much all I can give you on that. If you're able to search the web, I think you're okay. Make certain you got the latest Java kit downloaded. If you still can't get on, check that those VPN settings. These were great, great questions.
And you can send us questions by going to techtalkonline.com. While there, you can learn everything you ever wanted to know about this radio program, including listening to past shows. Learn more about our sponsor, Stratford University, by going to stratford.edu. You're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM HD2. More of Tech Talk continues right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tysons Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Now it's time for one of our favorite segments for the show.
You caught me short over here. I done messed something up.
Profiles in IT.
And there we go. Today, we're going to talk about John von Neumann. Now, von Neumann, Dr. von Neumann, was born in Budapest, Hungary in 1903. Von Neumann was the oldest of three children of a banker. Now, John von Neumann is known for his contributions to a wide range of fields, including mathematics, mathematical logic, quantum mechanics, economics, game theory, strategic thinking, and computer architecture, which, of course, is why he's on Profiles in IT. Dr. von Neumann was a pioneer of the modern computer. He devised the computing infrastructure, which is now known as the von Neumann architecture, which I'll explain a little bit later. And all current-day computers, computers developed since the mid-40s, have followed in much the same pattern after the von Neumann architecture, although recently we've taken some deviation with parallel processing, which I'll explain later. Now, he was quite a wizard. At age 6, he could divide 2 8-digit numbers in his head. By 8...
I still can't do that.
By 8, he had mastered calculus.
Wow!
By 12, he was studying at the graduate level in mathematics. So clearly, the guy had the head for math.
Yeah.
In 1925, he received his bachelor's degree in chemical engineering from the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. And in 1926, he completed his doctoral degree in mathematics from the University of Budapest. In 1930, he joined the Princeton Institute for Advanced Study. He became one of the first full-time people in the School of Mathematics. Now get this, one of the other six was Albert Einstein. So it kind of classifies him in the level of person that he was. He published his first book in 1932 on quantum mechanics. He became a U.S. citizen in 1937, and during World War II distinguished himself for his work on weapons development, most notably calculating projectile trajectories and work on the atom bomb. During and after the war, he became an applied mathematician when some of the best engineers in the world were at Los Alamos trying to decide how to bring atomic fuels together quickly enough to create an explosion, or the A-bomb, as it became known later on. He developed a technique for the implosion of plutonium by developing what was called the implosion lens that correctly would compress plutonium. See, there were two ways to get critical mass. One way was to have two subcritical masses that were separated by each other and take sort of a rifle and fire one into the other one and bring them close together so when they were fused, they would get critical mass, you'd get an explosion. The other way was to take an object like some plutonium that was too large to be a critical mass and then compress it smaller and smaller and smaller until it had sufficient density to be critical mass. And that's what he did with the implosion lens, to sort of compress plutonium to prior to the explosion. He did that through modeling. His work is said to accelerate the development of the hydrogen bomb. During the last part of the war, and this is where we get into the IT part, he was involved in the development of computing machines. Now, his idea, and this was an innovative idea, was to store the program, which is a sequence of instructions. You know, the computer program is a sequence of instructions that you want the computer to operate, into the machine as simply another form of electronic data. So in the memory, you've got the program in one part of the memory and the data in another part, and you'd have a number or a counter or a pointer, which would indicate what is the next program step to be executed. Now, this was quite an innovative thought, because before that point, they had the data in storage, and they would hardwire the computer to do a particular kind of calculation. And then if you'd want to do another calculation, you'd have to go in and change the wiring. So the program was in wiring rather than in memory, and so he came up with an architecture that would allow that. Von Neumann also was a strong proponent of using binary, because many of the computers up to that point actually were based on base 10 or digital, and you had to have a digital counter. And he said, look, our memory's got either an on switch or an off switch. Using binary arithmetic would certainly make much sense. So he pled for the use of binary. So after his effort, binary was really used. Of course, we talked about...
Last week we talked about binary.
Yeah, we talked about binary, which was proposed by Leibniz back in the 1700s. So coming out of his work in the electronic computer, he actually came up with an architecture called the von Neumann architecture. Now, the von Neumann architecture has four properties. Instructions and data are only distinguished through their usage, and they're both in memory. Memory in the machine is a single memory sequentially addressed. Memory is always one-dimensional. It means each is just a one-dimensional number which specifies the memory. And the meaning of the data, whether it's a floating-point number or a fixed-point number or a program step, is not stored with the data at all. It's simply there's going to be an address pointer, and the program is going to indicate what the value and how to interpret the data. Those four properties were in the von Neumann architecture. Now, after the war, in 1945, von Neumann drafted a report and a machine description that would lead to the construction of the next generation computer, which was called the Electronic Discrete Variable Automatic Computer, or EDVAC. Now, after the development, and the EDVAC was based on the von Neumann architecture, after the EDVAC, he worked on the electronic computer project at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study, and he developed a computer called the Mathematical Analyzer Numerical Integrator Computer, M-A-N-I-A-C.
Maniac.
The maniac.
I think he was probably looking for that.
I think he was working his way back from the acronym.
That's right. Yeah. And so he developed the maniac computer, which at that time
was called it Maniac.
Yeah.
Which was the fastest computer of its time, of its kind at the time. And the Maniac ran on thousands of vacuum tubes, because this predated the invention of the computer. Now, of the invention of the transistor, I should say. He was appointed to the Atomic Energy Commission in 1955. He died in 1957. So he died at quite
a really young age.
He died at a young age. He died at only 54. And he had quite an impact on everything. But, you know, he wrote a book on game theory, which was the application of probability statistics to business modeling. And that game theory book became one of the classics in game theory. I mean, it's still used today. Have you ever heard of something called the Monte Carlo method, where they model like complex economic events are complex? It's sort of a statistical method. He developed the Monte Carlo technique for statistical modeling. So he contributed to many, many areas. But the von Neumann architecture is what he is known for, and that's why he's in here, profiles in IT. In more recent times, we have deviated from the von Neumann architecture. We've gone to parallel processing, where you've got multiple commands being processed at the same time. And of course, the von Neumann architecture was a serial processing unit. So we've deviated from the classic von Neumann when we went to parallel processing. And also, in certain recent times, they have started tagging data and data types in the memory itself with the data. And that's also a violation of the classic von Neumann architecture. So we're evolving from it. But the power of that architecture, though, you know, it can be seen in the fact that most machines follow that von Neumann architecture, and they still do. And it's, you know, it's 55 years later.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things I find in every week we do the profiles in IT, how many good stuff actually came from people who are trying to blow stuff up? Because a lot of these guys are working on defense stuff and working on the A-bomb, and a lot of the computer technology came from that.
Yeah, the impetus for the computer technology back in the mid-in the 40s was really driven by our desire to do modeling of complex processes. That's exactly right.
So there you have it, another episode of
Profiles in
to make us good there.
It.
I'm so sorry that I messed it up. I'm just a klutz with the fingers.
No.
Thank you for listening to Tech Talk Radio. Your chance to show us how well you listen and retain information is coming up. Your chance to win free food on the pop quiz on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Stand by. More coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now,
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Russ. Once again this week, we drop the academic bar as I sit in for Dr. Schertz in my role as adjunct professor for academic laziness here on the Tech Talk program. And I administer the pop quiz. And we just talked about John von Neumann, one of the true pioneers of the computer industry. While he was at the Princeton Institute of Applied Study, he developed a computer which had a kind of a funny name. If you can tell me what the name of that computer was, you will win tickets for two for fine dining at the Escoffier at Stratford University on the campus in Falls Church, or at Cafe Karim at the campus in Woodbridge, Virginia. The number to call if you're calling from west of Princeton, New Jersey, is 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of Budapest, Hungary, it's 877-936-9333. And, of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. As always, Andrew Mitchell, adjunct professor for prize distribution, is standing by to take your calls at 877-936-9333. This is the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio.
Now, you know, there are five things that entrepreneurs can learn from the bad boy Einstein. You know, we never get back to the personality quirks of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
I found these comments at esoupblog.com. this is my source. It's kind of an interesting deal. But, you know, every field needs a bad boy. It doesn't matter whether it's in figure skating or physics or tennis. There's always a bad boy.
You know what? Bad boy and figure skating just doesn't go together.
Okay, well, there have been bad girls in figure skating, you know, with the...
that whole wood across the knee thing. Tonya Harding.
Tonya Harding. Well,
Trailer
Albert
Crash.
Einstein.
I'm sorry,
was,
did I say that?
Albert Einstein was the bad boy in the science world. He was really an outsider. He was misunderstood. Couldn't get a job at a university. Couldn't get an academic job. Had to become a patent officer. He couldn't even get a doctorate in his field of expertise. Now, but Einstein had certain core beliefs that really drove how he approached problems. And there are five of quotes from Einstein that I think are very useful for entrepreneurs or people that are trying to do something new today. Einstein's one of his more famous quotes is, "Imagination is more important than knowledge."
That, you know what? That's very important. And I think that works for all facets of life, doesn't it?
It really does. It doesn't matter. You could know all the technical aspects of something, but sometimes if you know all the technical aspects, it sort of limits. You can't see beyond what you know.
And if you have an idea, chances are you can find somebody that will help you make it happen.
That's right. Exactly. But if all you do is focus on the nuts and the bolts of it, you never see beyond the nuts and the bolts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second quote from Einstein, anybody who's never made a mistake has never tried anything new.
Yeah.
See, whenever you're creating something out of the blue, it's going to take a lot of tweaking before you get it just right. You're really working on something. You don't know if the end result. I mean, half the time it's a total failure, and occasionally it's a success. So people that are constantly trying new things, they fail a lot. And if you're always proud of the fact you've never made a mistake, or if you fear failure, chances are you're not going to try anything new.
Well, the important thing is to learn from your mistakes.
I can tell you the only way to learn how to ski is to fall down.
I mean, when
I did a lot of falling while I was learning how to ski.
Well, the only place I think where that doesn't work is aviation.
Well, okay.
You don't want to make too many mistakes there.
Yeah.
All right. You can't make
a V with your skis while you're in the air flying.
unless you're using a simulator.
Yeah, of course. Right.
Now, great spirits often encounter violent opposition from weak minds.
Of course.
Now, I think this quotation always helps you put your opposition in the right light. It could be a major vote motivator. So the people that are fighting your ideas the most probably have weak minds.
Mm-hmm.
And you just want to show them your vision, show them what you're doing, and the trick is to turn all their negative energy into positive energy. And then someday you can come back and show them how right you were.
It's a lot like that quote from Gandhi. Was it, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win?
Well,
yeah.
Don't you think a lot of this is jealousy because the weak-minded don't have your vision and they are jealous that you had this great idea?
Yeah, it could very be motivated by jealousy. That's right. Now, the next quote from Einstein, bad boy, the only real valuable thing is intuition.
Mm-hmm.
He said you need to develop kind of a gut feel that'll help you detect if a person or an idea or a situation is healthy for you. People who have the best intuition, and intuition is sort of a subliminal thought process. The people who have the best intuition tend to have the greatest success. And the last observation from Bad Boy Einstein, we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking that we use to create the problem.
Good point.
You've got to think out of the box. You've got to walk down a different pathway. And that's why frequently if you mix two fields together, at the juncture of those two fields, ideas from one field applied to a different field many times produce extremely innovative ideas. Einstein's creativity was heavily influenced by a thinking technique that he called the thought experiment, which, you know, many people just say was plain old-fashioned daydreaming. This goes to show you that imagination, play, and a willingness to try new things are the key to being visionary. So there are some thoughts from Bad Boy Einstein, the guy who couldn't even get a job at a university.
Very interesting. You know, it's kind of funny. I was thinking the other day, I get problems at the office. I can't come up with a solution to it. You know, no matter how hard I try, it's when I least expect it that something comes to me. A lot of times I'll be at a baseball game or someplace completely removed from that experience of being in the office, and something comes to me, and that's how I'm going to fix something.
That's right.
We're glad you're fixed to your radio today because you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 1035 FM HD2. More Tech Talk follows the break right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Budget analyst, a vice president of sales. These are today's business leaders, and a degree from Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers you a powerful path to navigate the corporate world. The School of Business Administration at Stratford University offers both bachelor's and master's degree programs for a real-world education. In fact, many of today's Stratford business grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. An executive chef at a trendy restaurant, a hotel general manager at a prestigious resort. These are the high-profile positions in the culinary arts and hospitality management industry. Get working towards your bachelor's or master's degree at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus. In fact, many of today's Stratford culinary arts and hospitality grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. We're in the virtual faculty lounge of Stratford University talking technology. We've got somebody on the line here who knows something about Einstein.
We do. Let's welcome Greg from Frederick, Maryland to Tech Talk. Greg, you have a friend who is a student of Einstein. Tell us your story.
Yes, Dr. Maurice Brooks. Met Einstein when he was still in high school, University of Ohio. He spent the last six summers with Einstein before his death. And I just wanted to verify that one thing that Doc mentioned that they did a lot was watch the clouds and daydreamed.
Interesting.
They
did a lot of sailing together. But if they weren't sailing, they were watching clouds and talking theology usually.
That's an interesting point. A lot of people didn't know that Einstein was a sailor.
No, I did not realize that.
He was very much loved sailing. And Doc sailed in Einstein's boat, the Windsong.
Very interesting.
Nice.
Had some great stories that he told. Unfortunately, Doc passed away last year.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Anything particularly quick and funny or interesting you could pass on, any of those stories that he told you?
I think one of the most fascinating things is Doc got a double PhD twice.
Wow.
His first one in electrical engineering and nuclear engineering, nuclear physics, And the second double PhD was in psychology and theology.
Interesting.
Interesting. Hey, Greg,
well,
thanks.
Doc went on to work for Bell Labs.
Well, there we go. Another science success story. Greg, thank you very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Back another time, all right?
All right.
Take care.
You know, that was an interesting story.
Yeah.
You know, Einstein was, I think even in his later years, he was a little misunderstood. In his middle years, his most prime years, when he was doing general relativity and special relativity, he was really very productive. At the end of his life, he could not accept the indeterminate nature of quantum mechanics, and it really troubled him, and he was searching for a way to unify the grand unification theory without resorting to quantum mechanics, and it was I think he was barking up the wrong tree, and it led to great frustration in the latter part of his life.
This is Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday morning on Federal News Radio in Washington, D.C., 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. More of Tech Talk in just a moment. Learn more about this program by going to techtalkonline.com, and learn more about our sponsor, Stratford University, by going to stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Application and software developers shape our world. Those who design and build these systems are the leaders we follow. The School of Computer Information Systems at Stratford University's Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers programs with a real-world, hands-on education. In fact, many of today's Stratford IT grads are working in their chosen field. Make it work for you. Stratford University. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu. A rewarding future as a holistic caregiver or nurse practitioner. Combining the art of caring with the human science makes nursing today's breakout field. Stratford University's School of Nursing at the Tyson's Corner or Woodbridge campus offers a patient-centered approach with valuable core clinical training. Stratford provides a real-world education in nursing. In fact, many of today's Stratford nursing grads are working in their chosen fields. Make it work for you. Get working. Check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. We're talking technology in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. Now we're going to talk about food science and food technology.
I love this segment. This is so much fun.
Now, you know, and we're going to talk about the tongue. You know, this is where the receptors for taste are located.
Mm-hmm.
These receptors are called taste buds. They're situated chiefly on the tongue, but they're also located on the roof of the mouth, and some of them near the back in the throat area. Our taste buds detect just five basic flavor sensations. They detect sweet, salty, sour, bitter, and savory. Now, savory is also called umami, for taste receptors sensitive to amino acids. That's better, but the interesting thing is that individuals have different taste thresholds for these. Now, generally speaking, the taste buds close to the tip of the tongue are more sensitive to sweet, and those at the back of the tongue are more sensitive to bitter taste. And there used to be sort of a map of taste buds on the tongue. Now, that map has actually been shown to be wrong, so a lot of what's on the internet is incorrect. It's been more recent research has shown that it's not so.
Oh, the hell you say. Wrong information on the internet.
I know it's a shock.
It's unbelievable.
It's a shock that there could be anything wrong on the internet.
And you know what? I've never tasted an amino acid before, to my knowledge. What does an amino acid taste like?
I don't know. I don't know how to describe that, really. Amino acid. You know, I really don't know how to get at that particular taste verbally.
I've never asked for an amino acid flavored snow cone before.
Now,
The
base of each taste bud, there's a nerve that sends sensations to the brain. Now, the other thing is that the taste is coordinated with smell, because now all these signals come into the brain.
Right.
and then what you're expecting to taste, if it's been a, if there's been a precursor smell that comes through the nose, then you're expecting a certain flavor, and bingo, you, your threshold for that flavor is enhanced, and you, you tend to taste it. And so there's a very strong correlation between the smell and taste.
This is why you might drool before you chomp into something that smells really good.
And it's possible, you know, somebody, you could smell an onion and then taste an apple, and the apple will have an onion taste to it.
Interesting.
It's because you expect it there. So it will pull out some of the elements of apple that are in an onion. You say, oh, yeah, I can taste onion in that. But it's so you can trick people, you can blindfold people, and you can really fool them into not realizing what they're eating. Now, the interesting thing is that people have completely different thresholds for taste. This is what I didn't realize, how widely varying it is. Just like people have different eyesights, their audio sensitivities are different. And so there's different thresholds for taste. Now, I got a couple of tastes on the Internet. There's one at sciencebuddies.org, and they have something for measuring your taste threshold. And what they do, they measure it for salt, granulated sugar, vinegar, are the three primary flavors that they're tasting. And they have an experiment where you basically make a 10% solution, molar solution of each of these, and tell you how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to a 1%, and then a 0.1%, and a 0.01%, and you keep stepping it down by a factor of 10 each cycle until finally you can't taste it. And so then you figure out what was your threshold for that particular taste. Now, I found another taste test, which was in the from Colorado State University, the physiology of taste, and they have another threshold, taste threshold. Now, it's very this particular test basically does provide a way to measure your threshold for salty, for sour, for sweet, for bitter, as well as for umami, which is the amino acid taste. And you're actually using glutamate for that. Glutamate has that taste. I really don't know what glutamate is, but that's the object you use. The bitter one you use quinine. The sweet you use sucrose.
It's artificial sugar.
The sour, I'm a little worried about that. They say HCl. I mean, that's hydrochloric acid.
I don't think you want to be putting that on your tongue.
I'm thinking there's something
general
wrong.
Now,
for the salty, of course, we're using you're using sodium chloride. I think I'm going to have to read a little bit further.
Just a little bit of acid right on the tip of your tongue. Yes,
I find it very interesting, though, that taste is like vision, and that people have varying amounts of taste buds. You say here that women generally have more than men.
I found that. I mean, that's true.
I wonder if that has any correlation to that. You know, that men have a tendency to eat more than women because we need to satisfy that taste thing. I don't know.
I don't know. But
I'm just grabbing straws here.
That's a good question, actually.
But that's interesting. But you know what? We've come up with a problem here. And based on our last segment, I'm trying to think out of the box today. So what I'm going to do, this is going to be my million-dollar idea. I'm going to come up with reading glasses for the tongue. Improve people's taste.
That is a great idea.
Think that'll work?
Oh yeah, that is a fantastic idea. You'll just have to somehow to convert with a lens for liquid.
Yeah.
Some kind of liquid lens, and then you'll be set. But what we do with our students in the culinary department, because people, when they start cooking, they don't realize that their taste could be dramatically different than others. And so we have the students calibrate their tongue, and they'll run a taste test operation, and then we have them cook for others. And they learn how to calibrate by the response of other people, instead of by their own tongue. And you've really got to do that if you're a cook. Haven't you noticed there's some people, whenever they make something, it's always there's some people who always make things too spicy or too salty because they're out of calibration. And if you're going to cook for others, you've got to calibrate for others. And that was one of the first lessons we have in culinary arts. So there you go.
And there you have it. That's it for this week. More next Saturday at 9 on Tech Talk Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and federalnewsradio.com. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated.